safety as he stepped back and looked at the body of Thad Lee Wood. It was euphoric, actually, and filled him with an indescribable sense of power, control, and the best, revenge. From that moment on, he knew he would never stop. 7 years after Lee Wood, and with 3 under his belt, he finally found Eileen. She was selling real estate north of Myrtle Beach. Her pretty, smiling face splashed on every yard sign possible as if she were running for city council. She had listings in a beachside development of 40 condos. He rented one of the others for the summer of 1998 before he became a judge. On a Sunday morning, he lured her to an empty unit, one she was trying to sell, price reduced, and the very second when she froze as if she remembered him, he splintered her skull with Letty. As the rope cut deep and she breathed her last, he hissed into her ear and reminded her of her mockery. 5 hours passed before there was a commotion. As things became frantic and people yelled, he sat with a beer on the balcony of his rental and watched across the courtyard as first responders scurried about. The sounds of sirens made him smile. He waited a week for the cops to come around knocking on doors and looking for witnesses, but they never showed. He paid his lease in full and never returned to the condo. The crime occurred in the seaside town of Sunset Beach in Brunswick County, North Carolina. 9 years passed before the county digitized its records, and when it happened, Bannock was waiting with his first generation of spyware. As with all the other police departments, he updated his data often, always on the prowl for any movement, always watching with the latest hacker's toys. The Eileen story had gone cold after a couple of years. There was never a serious suspect. The file reflected some occasional interest from crime writers, reporters, family members, and other police departments. Late Friday afternoon, Bannock sent in Rafe to snoop around for the first time in months. Based on the latest digital time and date stamp, the file had not been touched in 3 years, not since a reporter or someone claiming to be wanted to have a look. 23. The orange stayed down. He tried to nap, but was too wired. He grabbed his gym bag and walked around the corner where he spent 2 hours spinning, rowing, lifting, and pounding the treadmill. When he was beyond exhaustion, he stuck his head into the steam room. When he was certain he would be alone, he stripped and entered and stretched out on his towel. It was a mistake to call Norris Osment, but he'd had no choice. Osment could now link him directly to Verno, the same way Tabor had linked him. But it was unlikely that the authorities in Mississippi would ever find Osment, and even unlikelier that he would bother to go to them. Why should he? The judge massaged his temples and tried to breathe slowly as the steam soothed his lungs. The person who filed the complaint with BJC did so anonymously and with the understanding that nothing would be entered into a digital file. Everything would be kept offline. The person who hired Raleigh Tabor to pose as Jeff Dunlap and snoop through the old court case did so with the agreement that Tabor would store nothing online. The person who mailed the two anonymous letters went to great lengths to remove all possible clues. The person knew about Eileen Nickelberry. All these persons were the same. There was simply no other explanation. The evidence was far too coincidental. It was imperative to find this person. And if he found him, what would the good judge do? He could certainly kill him. That would be easy enough. But was it too late? Did Ms. Stoltz at BJC have enough damning evidence to go to the police? He told himself the answer was no, and he believed it. Accusing and indicting were easy enough, but convicting would be impossible. He presided over murder trials, studied forensics, and knew more about the science than the experts. And, most importantly, he knew how much evidence was needed to convict. A hell of a lot. Beyond a reasonable doubt. Far more than any low-paid cop had been able to find along his graveyard trail. There were a dozen on his list, give or take, more or less. 10 down, 2 to go, maybe 3. Dunwoody didn't count because he was never on the list. His timing was bad, and he was one victim that still troubled the judge. He didn't deserve to die like the others. Troubled as he was, though, there was nothing he could do about it. And now there were far more serious troubles. A killer can't help but look over his shoulder. And for years, he had feared this reckoning. In fact, he'd had so much time to think about it that he had pieced together several possible reactions. One was to simply go away, vanish, before being subjected to the humiliation of an indictment, arrest, and trial. He had plenty of money, and there was a big world out there. He had traveled extensively and been to several places where he could easily blend in and never be found. He preferred those countries beyond the reach of U.S. extradition treaties. Another strategy was to stay and fight. Declare innocence, even persecution, and lawyer up for a big trial. He knew precisely who to hire for his defense. No jury could convict him because no police department had the evidence. It was his firm belief that no prosecutor would ever indict for the same reason. No sitting judge had ever been put on trial for murder in America, and to do so would cause a media circus of epic proportions. Even the most ambitious prosecutor would shy away from the horror of losing before such an audience. Which of his murders would be the easiest to prove at trial? It was the great question that he toyed with almost every day. Because of his cunning and brilliance, he was of the lofty opinion that none of them could survive past the indictment phase. Staying and fighting was the most attractive option. Staying would allow him to finish his list. The last strategy was the easiest. He could simply end the game himself and take his crimes to his grave. Judge Bannock allowed himself a martini late on Friday afternoons, usually with another judge or two, and there were several preferred bars in the area. One favorite was at a club on the oceanfront with the Gulf stretching in the distance. On this Friday, though, he was in no mood for socializing, but he did need the martini. He mixed it in the back room and sipped it in the vault. And as he did so, he asked himself the obvious question: who is this person? A cop would not bother with anonymous mail. Why waste the time? Why alert the suspect? Why play games? And the cops weren't looking. He had hacked his way into all the police departments, and he knew how cold the files were. The sheriff in Biloxi and his detective Napier were still working the case every day. But that was only because there were two victims, and one was local. They had nothing to show for their efforts, and now, after 6 months, they were following the same pattern as the others. A private investigator would cost too much money. Regardless of the hourly rate, there was simply too much labor involved to link the murder of Eileen in 1998 in North Carolina to the murder of Perry Kroenke in 2012, then to Verno and Dunwoody in Biloxi last fall. No one could afford such a project. He knew his victims and their families well. Perry Kroenke was by far the wealthiest of the lot, but his widow was in poor health and probably reluctant to spend a fortune trying to find his killer. His two sons were Miami businessmen of modest success. Bannock stepped to a corner and pulled back a rug. With a key, he unlocked a safe hidden under the flooring and removed a thumb drive. He stuck it into his computer, pecked here and there, and within seconds, a file labeled Cronky appeared. Since he had researched and written everything in the file, he knew it by heart, but the constant review of his past was part of his life. Constant vigilance was just as important as meticulous planning. Cronky's estate had been probated in Monroe County, Florida, 4 months after his murder. His older son, Roger, was named executor of his will and was so appointed by the court. Inventories of assets were filed on time. There were no mortgages and no debts other than routine credit card charges. At the time of his death, Cronky and his wife jointly owned their retirement home, appraised at $800,000, two rental homes at $200,000 each, a stock portfolio valued at $2.6 million, a money market account with a balance of $340,000, and various bank accounts that totaled $90,000. With his cars and boat and other smaller assets, the inventory added up to $4.4 million. The estate file was public record. Hacking into the probate judge's office email had been a breeze because of maggots and its familiarity with the entire Florida court system. Rafe was also spying on Mrs. Cronky and her finances as a new widow. He watched her bank records and knew that she drew a Social Security check of $2,000 a month, a retirement check from the law firm for $4,500 a month, and $3,800 from a 401k. The bottom line was that she had plenty of cash. There was no indication she was writing big checks to private investigators. She didn't email much. There was correspondence between her and the two sons. She was contemplating selling the house and moving into an expensive retirement village. Emails between the sons indicated the usual worries about mom spending too much and screwing up their inheritances. There had been no chatter about devoting time and money to search for the killer. Bannock convinced himself that the person was not stalking him on behalf of the Cronky family. At the other end of the economic ladder was Lanny Verno. Having no estate, nothing had been probated. He left behind no assets, no children, no close family, nothing to hack, nothing but a live-in lady who'd come and gone and had shacked up with plenty. Verno was the last person on his list who might send in the investigators. Bannock jumped to another file labeled Eileen Nickelberry. Her family was just as doubtful. She had died 16 years earlier with no will and few assets. Her mother had been dragged into court to serve as administrator of her estate. Her condo and car were hawked and sold to satisfy the loans and pay off her credit cards. After all debtors were satisfied, her parents, who were divorced, and two siblings split about $4,000. Interestingly enough, her father hired a lawyer to explore a wrongful death claim against the owner of the condo development where she was murdered. Rafe watched the emails for a year or so as the lawsuit fizzled. Bannock was intrigued by the idea of lawyers, not cops, digging through the murder. The police were baffled from the start, as were the lawyers, and the investigations went nowhere. Other than a handyman with no criminal record and a solid alibi, there had never been a suspect. Another perfect murder. The last one mentioned by the person was Mike Dunwoody. Bannock went to his file, certain that his family had not hired private investigators. His murder was only 5 months old, and Sheriff Black and Detective Napier were doing and saying all the right things to convince the public they were making progress. The family seemed content to mourn in private and trust the authorities. Dunwoody's will left everything to his wife and named her as executrix. 5 months on, she had yet to begin probate. According to their bank records, personal and business, the company fell in line with most home contractors. Up 1 year, down the next, successful as a whole, but no one was getting rich. It was impossible to believe they were in a position to spend tens of thousands on their own investigation. The person was not a cop and not a private eye. However, he was clearly using people like Raleigh Tabor to snoop around. Who would hire an investigator from Mobile? Someone looking for a story, a reporter, a freelancer, a writer, would not have the patience to pursue such a project for so long. Money was their motive, and who could survive decades without a payoff? He mixed another martini and took it to the front room where he sat on the sofa in the dark. He sipped it slowly and felt the gin work its way into his muddled brain. For a few moments, the pain subsided. He was sick of the place, but felt safe there. No one could see him. No one in the world knew where he was. For a man who had stalked his prey for most of his adult life, he found it terrifying that there was now someone out there watching him. His victims, though, never had a clue. He, on the other hand, knew the awful truth that someone was on to him. He had lost track of time, and his cell phone was in the vault. He stretched out on the sofa and fell into a deep sleep. As he slept, Rafe went about his work, rummaging through the sparse and disjointed network of the Atlas Finders, otherwise known as the small office of Raleigh Tabor, PI. He wormed his way into the computer of a part-time secretary named Susie, and there he found some photos. One was of her and her boss, Mr. Tabor. Hours later, Bannock looked into the smiling face of Raleigh and easily matched the photo with the one taken by Norris Osment's security camera and also the one from Dunlap's fake driver's license. It confirmed what he already knew. Raleigh Tabor, a run-of-the-mill private dick in Mobile, had been hired by someone to dig through Bannock's quite dirty laundry. But Rafe could find no other clues with Atlas. It would be necessary to hack into Tabor's cell phone, a task Bannock was not quite up to. With diligent study and plenty of practice, he had become an accomplished amateur hacker of computers, but the smartphones were another story. He was still learning, but wasn't quite there. It was still dark when he finally ventured from his bunker at just minutes before 6 a.m. on Saturday morning. The 24-hour gym was deserted, as was the parking lot. He was eager to get home and left in a hurry, the only car on the road. Turning onto the street, he caught himself glancing into the rear view. Then he almost laughed at the absurdity. 20 minutes later, he drove through the gates of his well-protected community in Cullman and parked in front of his garage as the sun peeked through the clouds in the east. He turned off the engine, took his smartphone, turned off the security system, and checked the surveillance cameras and recent footage. Assured that all was safe, he finally got out and went inside where he flipped on lights and made a pot of coffee. He watched it brew and tried to shake off the cobwebs from the martinis. He poured a cup and slowly walked through his den to the front door. He opened it, took a step onto his porch, looked up and down the street, then reached into the small mailbox mounted beside the door. Another plain white envelope, no return address. It seemed harmless enough. Another water park at the beach. Bulldoze, burn, and build. Another pot of gold just within reach. You tried to hide in the dark, your good name nowhere to be seen. Cowering behind your partners, directing the little scheme. Oh, the beauty of a free press. To find the truth, expose the lies. Keep the crooks out of office, keep the judges fair and wise. Your loss to the old one hurt badly and killed your enormous pride. So you blamed me for your corruption and relished the day I died. 24. The lazy Saturday morning was interrupted twice before Lacey made it to the coffee pot. The first call awakened her at 8:03. Caller unknown, potential spam. In other words, don't answer. But something said do it. And if it happened to be a robocall, she could simply hang up, as always. Good morning, Lacey, Jerry said softly. A flash of anger passed quickly as Lacey controlled herself. Good morning, Jerry. What's the occasion? Just thinking about you a lot these days. How are you? Well, I was sleeping, Jerry, before you called. It's Saturday, a day off, and I'm not working today. I thought I had explained this. I'm sorry, Lacey, Jerry said in a tone that conveyed anything but remorse. Why does it have to be considered work? Why can't we talk as friends? Because we're not friends yet, Jerry. We are acquaintances who met for the first time about a month ago. We may become friends one day once the work that brought us together is finished, but we're not there yet. I see. The word friend gets tossed around loosely, don't you think? I suppose. And whatever the reason for this call, it's not about friendship. It's probably on the business side. It is, Lacey, and I'm sorry to bother you. It's Saturday morning, Jerry, and I was sleeping. Got it. Look, I'll hang up now, but first let me say what I want, okay? Sure. There is a good chance that Bannock knows about the complaint and knows that you're digging through his past. I can't prove this, but I've come to believe that he has some type of superpower, extrasensory something, I don't know. But he is extremely bright and diligent, and, well, I guess I might be a bit paranoid. I've been living with him for so long, I just assume that he's everywhere. Be careful, Lacey. If he knows you're on his trail, he might do anything. I've thought about that, Jerry. Okay. Goodbye. She was gone, and Lacey immediately felt lousy for being so abrupt. The poor woman was a wreck and had been for many years, and Lacey should have been more patient. But it was early Saturday morning. She closed her eyes and was thinking about more sleep, but the dog was making noises. She was thinking about Allie and how nice it would be to have him beside her. And, wide awake now, she was thinking about Jerry Crosby and the sadness of her life. What she wasn't thinking about was her older brother and only sibling. When Gunther called, not 10 minutes after Jerry, Lacey had a hunch that her carefree day would not go as planned. He said he had a new airplane he wanted to show off. And with the weather perfectly gorgeous on this spring day, he had the urge to fly down and take his kid sister to lunch. I'm on the runway, taking off now, landing in Tallahassee in 84 minutes. Meet me at the airport. It was so typical of Gunther. The world revolved around him, and everyone else was just an extra. She fed and let out the dog, threw on some jeans, brushed her teeth, and headed to the airport, her quiet Saturday shot to hell. But she wasn't really surprised. Nothing about her brother was surprising. He was an avid pilot who swapped airplanes almost as fast as he bought and sold sports cars. He ran the women hard, too, and the bankers and investors. When the markets were up, he burned cash. And when things went flat, he kept borrowing until he couldn't. Even when the demand was high for his strip malls and tract housing, he seemed to totter along the edge of financial disaster. Because he was known to embellish and outright fabricate, Lacey had lost count of the times he had filed for bankruptcy. She thought there were 3, along with his 2 divorces and 1 near indictment. But regardless of his problems, Gunther slept hard every night and attacked each day with enthusiasm and confidence. His zest for life was contagious, and if he found himself in the mood to fly in for lunch, there was no way to stop him, regardless of what she had planned. Waiting in the private terminal, watching the small planes come and go while sipping a cup of bad coffee, she both dreaded and looked forward to seeing Gunther. With both parents gone now, they needed each other. Both were single and childless, and it certainly looked as if they would be the family's last generation. Trudy, their mother's sister, was trying to become the matriarch and getting too involved. Lacey and Gunther were united in their resistance. But she wasn't exactly thrilled to see him because he had too many opinions about almost everything. Since her car wreck, he'd had far too much to say about her lawsuit, her lawyer, their legal strategies. He thought she was wasting her time at BJC. He wasn't too keen on Ally Pacheco, though this was a reaction to Lacey's dislike of every girlfriend he had dared introduce her to. He thought Tallahassee was a hick town and she should move to Atlanta. He disapproved of her current car, and so on. There he was, crawling out of a sleek little plane, bounding down from the wing with no luggage, no briefcase, a Playboy out for a spin and a nice lunch. They hugged in the doorway and left the terminal. As soon as he buckled up, he said, "Still driving this cheap little thing?" "Look, Gunther, it's great to see you as always, but the last thing I want to hear today is a steady stream of bitching about my life, car included. Got that?" "Wow, sis, you wake up on the wrong side?" "I did. Did you see my airplane? Isn't it a beauty?" "I did. It's lovely, as far as airplanes go. Bought it last month from a guy whose wife caught him cheating. Sad." Gunther was anything but sad. "What is it?" she asked, but only because she had to. "A Cicada TBM 700 turboprop, all the bells and whistles. Think of a Ferrari with wings, 300 miles an hour. Got a real deal." A real deal for Gunther meant that he had convinced yet another banker to make a loan. "Sounds exciting. Looks pretty small. Seats 4, that's plenty for me. You want to go for a spin?" "I thought we were doing lunch." Lacey had been his passenger on 2 occasions, and that was enough. Gunther was a serious pilot who didn't play around and take chances, but he was still Gunther. "Right," he said, suddenly checking his phone. When he put it away, he asked, "How's Ally? Still seeing him?" "I am, hot and heavy. Who's your new squeeze?" "Which one? Look, I think it's time for this guy to either make a move or move on. It's been, what, 2 years now?" "Oh, so you've got marriage all figured out?" Gunther burst out laughing, and after a beat, Lacey did too. The idea of him giving advice on the romantic front was indeed humorous. "Okay, no more of that. You talked to Aunt Trudy lately? Where are we going?" "Home, so I can shower and brush my teeth. Didn't have enough time earlier." "How can you dawdle around so on such a gorgeous Saturday morning?" "No, I have not talked to Trudy. I owe her a phone call. You?" "No, I'm ducking her too. Poor thing. She's lost without Mom. They were best friends, and now she's stuck with that husband of hers." "Ronald's okay. He's a creep and you know it. They really don't like each other, but I guess after 50 years, they can't get out. Let's talk about something else. How's business these days?" I'd rather talk about Ronald. Pretty bad, huh? No, actually, I'm killing it. I need some help, Lacey, and I want you to come to Atlanta and work with me. Bright lights, big city, much more to do. We'll make a fortune, and there are a dozen great guys I could introduce you to. I'm not sure I want to date your friends. Come on, Lacey, trust me. These guys have money, and they're going places. How much does Allie make a year with the FBI? I have no idea, and I don't care. Not much. He's working for the government. So am I. That's my point. You can do better. Most of these guys are already millionaires who own their own companies. They have everything. Yeah, including alimony and child support. Gunther laughed and said, okay, some of that. Of course his phone rang, and he was soon lost in a tense conversation about a line of credit. On Saturday morning? He was still on the phone when she parked near her apartment. They went inside, and she left him in the den as she headed for her upstairs bedroom. Lunch was outdoors on a shaded terrace at an upscale restaurant, far away from downtown. Lacey talked the reservationist into an early table, primarily because she was still hoping to salvage some of her afternoon alone. They were seated at 11:30, and the terrace was deserted. They ordered iced tea for starters, with Lacey quickly going first. If Gunther ordered his usual bottle of wine, then he wouldn't be flying that afternoon. She was relieved when he ignored the wine list and commented on the menu. Usually, when dining in her town, he made some pithy comment on the lack of good food. Atlanta, again, was far superior. But he let it pass and settled on a crab salad. Lacey ordered grilled shrimp. You still eat like a bird, he said, admiring his sister. And you're in great shape, Lacey. Thanks, and let's not dwell on my weight. I know what you're getting at. Come on. You haven't gained a pound in 20 years. No, and I'm not starting now. What else would you like to talk about? Of course, you were all skin and bones after your car wreck. I almost called it an accident, but it wasn't that simple, was it? A nice lead into her lawsuit, which she was anticipating. She smiled and said, once all the plaster and gauze came off, I weighed 100 pounds. I remember. And you've come a long way back. I'm proud of you, Lacey. You're still in therapy? Physical or otherwise? Physical? Yes, twice a week, but it's about over. I've accepted the fact that I'll always have little aches and pains, some stiffness here and there, but I'm lucky, I guess. Gunther mixed some lemon in his tea and looked away. I wouldn't call it luck. But you came out of it better than Hugo, poor guy. Are you still in touch with his widow? What's her name? Verna, and yes, we're still close friends. She has the same lawyer, right? She does. We compare notes and lean on each other. Nobody wants a trial. I'm not sure she can handle it.
And we'll never get near the courthouse. The goons will settle.
Gunther had far more experience with civil litigation. Though his disputes dealt with broken contracts and defaulted loans, to her knowledge, he had no experience with personal injuries. I guess things are tied up in discovery, he said, trying to ease into the heart of the matter. Looks like it. My lawyer says I may have to give a deposition. I'm sure you've been there. Gunther snorted in disgust and said, oh yeah, a lot of fun. Staring across the table at five lawyers, all scheming to pounce on every word, every syllable, salivating as they dream of getting more of your money. Why can't your lawyer get the case settled? It should have been over months ago. It's complicated. Sure, there's a big pile of money, but that only attracts more vultures, more hungry lawyers. I get that. But what would you settle for, Lacey? What's your figure? I don't know. We're not there yet. You're entitled to millions, sis. Those bastards deliberately set you up and crashed into your car. You, please. I know all this, Gunther. and we're not going over it again. Okay, sorry, but I just worry about you. I'm not sure you have the right lawyer. As I've said before, Gunther, I can take care of myself and my lawyer. You don't need to waste time worrying about it. I know. Sorry. I'm your big brother and I can't help it. Their plates arrived and both seemed to welcome the interruption. They began eating and things went quiet. He was obviously preoccupied with ideas but couldn't manage to work them into the conversation. Her biggest fear was that he would need an infusion of cash at the same time she settled her lawsuit. He would never ask for the money outright as a gift, but would use the ploy of an urgent loan. If it happened, she was determined to say no. She knew he borrowed from Peter to pay Paul, hawked everything he owned, and walked the fine line between prosperity and financial ruin. He wasn't about to touch her money, when and if she ever got it. And if her refusal created a rift, then so be it. She would rather keep the money and deal with an ugly fallout than fork it over, watch him lose it, and then deal with a future filled with empty promises. He backed away from more discussion of her lawsuit and proceeded to talk about his favorite subject, his latest project. It would be a planned community with mixed housing, a central town square with a faux courthouse in the center, churches and schools, lots of water and trails, and the obligatory golf course, a regular utopia, a $50 million development with other investors, of course. Lacey forced herself to seem engaged. The terrace began to fill, and before long they were in a crowd. Gunther contemplated one glass of wine for dessert, but changed his mind when she ordered an espresso. He paid the check at 1 o'clock and said it was time to head to the airport. Another deal was hanging by a thread and he was needed in Atlanta. She hugged him goodbye inside the private terminal and watched him taxi away. She loved him dearly, but took a deep breath and relaxed when he was gone. 25. From his well-stocked closet, Judge Bannock selected a designer suit from Xenia, light gray in color, worsted wool, a white shirt with French cuffs, and a solid navy tie. He admired himself in the mirror and thought the look was rather European. Late Saturday afternoon, he left his home in Cullman and drove into central Pensacola, into an historic district known as North Hills. The streets were shaded with the canopies of old oaks, and their thick limbs were draped with Spanish moss. Many of the homes were 200 years old and had weathered hurricanes and recessions. As a kid in Pensacola, Ross and his pals rode their bikes through North Hills and admired the fine homes. It never occurred to him that he would one day be welcome in the neighborhood. He turned into the cobblestone driveway of a beautifully preserved Victorian and parked his SUV next to a shiny Mercedes sedan, then walked across the rear patio and tapped on a door. Melba, the ancient maid who kept Helen's life together, greeted him with her usual warm smile and said that the lady was getting dressed. Did he want a drink? He asked for a ginger ale and found his favorite seat in the billiard room. Helen was a widow and a girlfriend of sorts, though he had no interest in romance. Neither did she. Her third or fourth husband had died of old age and left her rich, and she preferred to hang on to the money. All prospective men of an age were after her assets, she assumed. Thus, their relationship was nothing more than a convenience. She loved being escorted around town with a handsome younger man and a judge at that. He liked her because she was witty and outrageous and never a threat. She said she was 64 years old, but this was doubted. Years of aggressive surgery had smoothed out some wrinkles, curved her chin, and brightened her eyes, but he suspected she was at least 70. His harem as he called it, but only to himself, consisted of several women ranging in age from 41 all the way up to Helen. To qualify, they had to be either rich or affluent and happily single. He was not in the market for a wife, and over the years had discarded several who got complicated. Melba brought his drink and left him in silence. Dinner was at 7:30, and there was no possible way they would arrive on time. For a judge who demanded punctuality in most matters, waiting for Helen demanded patience. So he waited, soaking up the fine, worn leather furniture, the Persian rugs, the paneled walls, the oak shelves laden with ancient books, the magnificent chandelier from another century. The house covered 10,000 square feet on 4 levels, and very little of it was used by Helen and Melba. He closed his eyes and recited the latest poem. Its author had now linked him to Danny Cleveland, the former reporter for the Ledger, disposed of in 2009, only 5 years ago. And before that, Eileen Nickelberry in 1998, and after, Perry Kroenke in 2012, then Verno and Dunwoody less than a year ago. He felt like his victims were now crawling out of their graves and lining up zombie-like to come after him. He was living in a state of stunned disbelief, his thoughts a mush of rampant flashes, his debates raging over strategies that changed by the hour. He closed his eyes and breathed deeply, then reached into a pocket, retrieved a loose capsule of Xanax, and chased it down with the ginger ale. He was taking too many of the pills. They were supposed to flatten his anxieties and relax him, but they weren't working anymore. Could it be possible that he was about to lose such a lofty and privileged place in life? Was he about to be exposed in some unimaginable way? The past that he had so brilliantly worked to conceal was now catching up with him. The present and all its status was at risk. The future was too horrible to dwell on. "Hello, darling," she said as she entered the room. Bannock jumped to his feet, threw out his hands for a polite hug, and offered sexless air kisses while saying, "You look marvelous, Helen." "Thank you, dear," she said, looking down at her red sleeveless dress. "You like it? Chanel." "Beautiful, stunning. Thank you, darling." She was from a small town in Georgia and fancied herself a real Southern belle. The darling came out as darling. She leaned in closer, frowned, and said, "You do look tired, Judge. Dark circles around the eyes. Are you battling insomnia again?" He had never been bothered with insomnia, but said, "I guess, a busy trial calendar." He was too polite to say, "Well, Helen, in that case, I notice an extra roll around the old waistline, not looking as svelte as you think." The good thing about Helen, and something he admired greatly, was that she never stopped trying. Always dieting, sweating, shopping for the latest fashions, studying the next surgical alternatives, buying the most expensive makeup, and applying it with gusto. She claimed to be waiting for the perfect female Viagra so she could hop in the sack like a teenager. Both had laughed at this because sex was a topic they avoided. She worked so hard at looking good that he could never say anything that might deflate her considerable ego. He looked at her feet, never a dull place, and smiled at her leopard skins. "Love your hooker's heels," he said with a laugh. "Jimmy Choo, always, darling." They said goodbye to Melba and left the house. As usual, they would take her Mercedes because, being a complete snob, Helen would be humiliated to be seen arriving at the country club in a Ford. Bannock opened the passenger door for her and got behind the wheel. It was already 7:40, and the club was 15 minutes away. They chatted about his busy week, her grandkids in Orlando, a rotten lot with problems that only serious money could create, And after about 10 minutes in traffic, she said, "You seem preoccupied, Judge. What's the matter?"
"Nothing at all. Just looking forward to a fabulous dinner of rubber chicken and cold peas."
"It's not that bad, really. But we can't seem to keep a chef."
Both were members and knew the truth. Every new head chef cooked for about 6 months before being fired. Each found it impossible to meet the exacting wishes of a high-end crowd that had convinced themselves they knew great food and wine. The Escambia Country Club was 100 years old and had 500 members, with another 100 prospects on the waiting list. It was the country club in the Pensacola area and the place where every affluent family wanted to belong. The climbers, too. It sat on a bay with water on three sides of the grand hall. Manicured fairways snaked away in several directions. The whole place, from the winding shaded drive to the 200 acres of perfect greenery, reeked of old money and exclusivity. The entrance was under a sweeping portico where the members arrived in German cars and were greeted by doormen in black tie. Only a red carpet was missing for the lucky ones. Helen loved saying, "Well, good evening, Herbert," as he opened the door, took her hand, and got her out of the car, just as he had been doing for years. Once shed of old Herbert, she took the elbow of Judge Bannock and swept into the magnificent foyer where waiters circulated with trays of champagne. Helen practically assaulted one to get a drink, and not her first of the day. The judge took a glass of sparkling water. He was in for a long night and an even longer Sunday. They were soon lost in a throng of well-heeled socialites. The men in the required suits and ties, the ladies in all manner of designer getup. The older ones favored clinging fabrics, dangerously plunging necklines and no sleeves, as if determined to exhibit as much aging flesh as possible to prove they still could turn it on. The younger ladies, a small minority, seemed content with their figures and felt no need to flaunt things. Everyone talked and laughed at once as the crowd slowly inched along a wide hallway with thick carpets and large portraits on the walls. Inside the main banquet room, they weaved their way through large round tables and eventually found their seating assignments. There was no speaker for the evening, no dais, no prime tables for sponsors. At the far end, a band tuned up behind a dance floor. The judge and Helen settled in with eight people they knew well. Four other couples, all properly married, but no one really cared about the arrangements. A doctor, an architect, a gravel entrepreneur, and their wives. And one man, the oldest at the table, who had dinner at the club every night with his wife and was reported to have inherited more money than all the others combined. The wine flowed, and the conversations roared. Judge Bannock flipped his switch and flipped it again and made himself laugh and smile and talk loudly about little that mattered. At times, though, he felt the weight of the future, the uncertainty of Monday's mail, the fear of being stripped naked and exposed, and he lapsed into moments of pensiveness. It was impossible not to look around the room at the friends and leaders and people he had always known and admired without asking, "What will they say?" He, decked in zenia and rubbing elbows with the rich, was a most respected judge, admired by important people, and he was also, at least in his opinion, the most brilliant killer in American history. He had studied the others, thugs, all, some downright ignorant. He told himself to shake it off and took a question about an oil spill in the Gulf. Some of the crude was inching toward Pensacola and the alarms were up. Yes, he surmised that there would be a great deal of litigation in the near future.
You know the plaintiff's bar, he said. They'll sue the moment the oil slick is in sight, and probably before. The spill was front page, and for a while the entire table quizzed His Honor on who might be able to sue whom. It passed. The women lost interest and pursued their own little chats as dinner was served. The waitstaff was well-trained and efficient, and no one's wine glass was ignored, especially Helen's. As usual, she was pounding Chardonnay and getting louder. She'd be drunk by 10, and he'd have to once again shovel her into the house with Melba's help. He was happy to be quiet and listen to the others. He looked around the large room, smiled and nodded, and acknowledged some friends. The mood was festive, even rowdy, and everyone was wearing beautiful clothes. The women were coiffured to perfection. Those over 40 had the same noses and chins, thanks to the handiwork of a Dr. Wrangle, the most sought-after facelifter in the Florida panhandle. He was sitting two tables away with his second wife, a gorgeous blonde of indeterminate age, though she was rumored to be in her early 30s. When Wrangle wasn't carving on women, he was sleeping with them. They found him irresistible, and his sexual escapades were the source of endless salacious gossip in town. Bannock loathed the man, as did many husbands, but he also secretly envied his libido and his current wife. There were two in the room he'd like to kill. Wrangle was the second. The first was a banker who had denied him a loan when he was 30 years old and trying to buy his first office building. He said Bannock's balance sheet was too light, and his chances of making good money as a lawyer were too unlikely. The town was already saturated with mediocre legal talent, and most ham and eggers around the courthouse were barely paying their bills. Typical banker, he thought he knew everything. Bannock bought another building, filled it with tenants, then bought another. As his law practice flourished, he joined the country club and ignored the banker. When he was elevated to the bench at the age of 39, the banker suffered a stroke and had to retire. Now he sat at a corner table, old and shriveled, and able only to mumble to his wife. He was sad and deserved sympathy, an emotion foreign to Bannock. But killing him or Wrangle would be too risky. A local crime in a small town, and their transgressions were too minor compared to the others. He'd never seriously considered putting them on the list. As dinner came to an end, the band began playing softly, mostly old Motown hits that the crowd loved. A few eager couples hit the floor during dessert. Helen liked to dance, and Bannock could hold his own. They skipped the cake, made their entrance, then jerked and gyrated through some Stevie Wonder and Smokey Robinson. After a few songs, though, she was parched and needed a drink. He left her at the table with her friends and went outside to the patio where the men were smoking black cigars and sipping whiskey. He was pleased to see Mac McGregor standing alone near the edge, a glass in one hand, a phone in the other. After 10 years on the bench, Bannock knew every lawyer between Pensacola and Jacksonville, and many others, too, and Mac had always been one of his favorites. They had both joined local firms about the same time, then spun off into their own shops. Mac loved the courtroom and quickly became a skilled and sought-after trial advocate. He was one of the few lawyers in the area who could take a case from the beginning, the injury or death, and push it all the way to a successful verdict. He was a pure trial lawyer, not a mass tort chaser, and he handled criminal cases as well. Bannock had seen his work firsthand, but he had never allowed himself to believe that one day he would need Mac's services. In the past 3 days, he had caught himself thinking about Mac far too much. If the sky fell, and Bannock still believed it would not, Mac would be his first call. "Evening, Judge," Mac said as he put away his phone. "Lose your girl? Ran him upstairs for a pee. Who's your squeeze tonight?" "A new one, a real cutie. My secretary fixed me up." Mac had been divorced for 10 or so years and was known to prowl. "Quite the looker." "That's all, believe me." "That's enough, right?" "It'll do." "Who's gonna get that tiki bar case in Fort Walton?"
"Don't know yet. Judge Watson will decide. You want it?"
"Maybe." A month earlier, two bikers from Arizona started a row in a low-end dive outside of Fort Walton Beach near the water. It went from fists to knives to guns, and when the glass stopped shattering, three people were dead. The bikers fled for a while, but were caught near Panama City Beach.
On the principle that every person accused of a serious crime has a right to a good lawyer, Mac and his partner volunteered each year for at least one murder case.
It kept them in the courtroom and sharp on the law. It also added some spice to their everyday practice. Mac enjoyed the gritty, often grisly details of a good murder case. He liked hanging around the jail. He enjoyed getting to know men who were capable of killing.
"Sounds like your kind of case."
"Life is pretty dull right now."
"Well, Mac, that might change soon for both of us," Bannock thought to himself.
"If you're volunteering, I can arrange things. Let me kick it around the office. I'll call you Monday. Probably not a capital case, right?"
"No, it was certainly not premeditated. Looks like a couple of idiots got drunk and started fighting."
"Are you signing up oil slick cases?"
"We'll get our share," Mac said with a laugh. "Half the bar's out in the Gulf right now in boats looking for crude. It'll be a bonanza.
As well as another environmental disaster." They killed time swapping stories about lawyers they knew and the lawsuits they chased. Mac pulled out a leather cigar case and offered a Cohiba. Both men fired one up and found some whiskey. They aborted the lawyer talk and returned to the more pleasant topic of younger women. After a while, Judge Bannock knew his date would be looking for him. He said goodbye to Mac, and as he walked away, he hoped he would not be seeing the lawyer anytime soon.
26. The handoff was rocky, as usual. Even in bare feet, Helen was unstable as they shuffled across the bricks of her rear patio.
"Do come in for a drink, darling," she cooed between breaths.
"No, Helen, it's past our bedtimes and I have a splitting headache."
"Wasn't it a great band? What a lovely evening."
Melba was waiting at the door and opened it for them. Bannock handed her the high heels, then handed her Helen, then turned and backed away. "Gotta run, dear. I'll call in the morning."
"But I want a drink."
Bannock shook his head, frowned at Melba, and hustled to his SUV. He drove to a shopping center and parked near other vehicles by the cinema. He walked to his other chamber, cleared himself through the scanners, and once inside, stripped out of his suit and tie and put on gym clothes. Half an hour after seeing the last of Helen, he was sipping espresso and again lost in the dark web, tracking Rafe's latest adventures. The vigilance was time-consuming and usually not productive. Still using maggots and sending Rafe to troll here and there, he was watching the police files of his cases. So far, no department had managed to successfully firewall its data and network. Some were easier to hack than others,
but none had been especially bothersome. He still marveled at the lax and weak security used by most county and city governments. 90% of all data breaches could be prevented with modest effort. Standard passwords such as admin and password were routinely used. The more tedious work was keeping up with the victims. There were 10 groups of them, 10 families he had destroyed, mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, children, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. He had no pity for them. He simply wanted them to stay away. The person stalking him was not a cop, not a private investigator, not some thrill-seeking true crime writer. The person was a victim, one who had been slithering back there in his shadows for many years, watching, gathering, trailing. A new reality had arrived, and he, in his brilliance, would deal with it. He would find the victim and stop the letters. Stop the silly poems. He had ruled out the families of Eileen Nickelberry, Perry Kroenke, Lenny Verno, and Mike Dunwoody. He went back to the beginning, to his most satisfying triumph. He opened the file on Thad Leawood and looked at the photos, some old black and whites from his scouting days, one of the entire troop at a jamboree, one taken by his mother in an awards ceremony, Ross standing proudly in his smart uniform, merit badge sash filled with colorful circles, Leawood with an arm around him. He studied the faces of the other scouts, his closest friends, and wondered, as always, how many others were abused by Leawood. He had been too afraid to ask, to compare notes. Walt Sneed once remarked that Leawood liked to touch and hug a bit too much for a 12-year-old's liking, called him creepy. But Ross had been too afraid to pursue the conversation. How could a seemingly normal young man rape a child, a boy? He still hated Leawood so many years later. He'd had no idea a man could do those things. He moved on, past the photos, always painful, and went to the family tree, such as it was. Leawood's brief obituary listed the names of his survivors, his parents, an older brother, no wife. His father died in 2004. His mother was 98 and living without her marbles in a low-end nursing home in Niceville. He had often thought about rubbing her out just for the hell of it, just for the satisfaction of getting revenge against the woman who created Thad Leawood. There were so many targets he had thought about over the years. The brother, Jess Leawood, left the area not long after the abuse rumors surfaced and settled in Salem, Oregon, where he had lived for at least the last 25 years. He was 78. Retired, a widower. 6 years earlier, Bannock, using a disposable phone, called Jess and explained that he was a crime writer and was digging through some old police files in Pensacola. Did Thad's family know that he had a history of abusing kids? The line went dead. The call was over. It served no purpose other than to punish a Leawood. As far as Bannock could tell, Jess had no contact with his hometown, and who could blame him? The last poem was about Danny Cleveland, the former reporter for the Pensacola Ledger. He was 41 when he died, divorced with 2 teenage children. His family hauled him back to Akron for the funeral and burial. According to their social media, his daughter was now a junior at Western Kentucky, and his son had joined the army. It seemed impossible to believe that either would be old enough to put together an elaborate plan to track a brilliant serial killer, and it was safe to assume his ex-wife wouldn't care who killed him. He scrolled through other files. Ashley Barrasso, the only girl he had ever loved.
They met in law school and had a delightful fling, one that ended abruptly when she ditched him for a football player. He was crushed and carried the wounds for 6 years until he caught her. When she was finally still, his pain suddenly vanished. His broken heart was healed. The score was even. Her husband gave interviews and put up $50,000 in reward money. But with time, it went unclaimed, and he moved on. He remarried 4 years later, had more children, and lived near D.C. Preston Dill had been one of his first clients. He and his wife wanted a no-fault divorce, but couldn't manage to scrape together the $500 fee. The two hated each other and had future spouses already lined up, but lawyer Bannock refused to take them to see the judge until he got paid. Preston then accused Bannock of sleeping with his wife, and everything blew up. He filed a complaint with the state bar, one of many over the years. His game was to hire a lawyer, stiff him on the fee, then complain when the work didn't get finished. All of Dill's complaints were dismissed as frivolous. 4 years later, they found him in a landfill near Decatur, Alabama. His family was scattered, unremarkable, and probably not suspicious. Professor Brian Burke, dead at the age of 62, his body found beside a narrow trail not far from his lovely little cabin near Gaffney, South Carolina. The year was 1992. Looking at his photo from the law school yearbook, Bannock could almost hear his rich baritone as it wafted over the classroom. "Tell us about this case, mister." And he always paused so they would squirm and pray someone else got the call. His students eventually came to admire Professor Burke, but Bannock didn't hang around long enough. After his nervous breakdown, one he blamed squarely on Burke, he transferred to Miami and began plotting his revenge. Burke had two adult children. His son, Alfred, worked for a tech company in San Jose and was married with three kids. Or that was where he had been during the last update some 18 months ago. Bannock dug around for a while and could not verify Alfred's current employment. Someone else now lived at his address. Obviously, he had changed jobs and moved. Bannock cursed himself for not knowing this earlier. It took an hour to find Alfred living in Stockton, employment unknown. Burke's daughter was Jerry Crosby, age 46, divorced, one child. The last update had her living in Mobile and teaching political science at South Alabama. He found the university's website and verified that she still taught there. Oddly enough, in the faculty directory, there were photos of the professors in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice, but not of her. Evidently, she was very private. An earlier file gave her undergraduate degree from Stetson, a master's from Howard in D.C., and a Ph.D. in political science from Texas. She married Roland Crosby in 1990, had a child within the first year, and divorced him 6 years later. In 2009, she joined the faculty at South Alabama. The Mobile link was intriguing. The investigator the person had hired, Raleigh Tabor, was based in Mobile. Bannock sent Rafe back into the Hertz records and fell asleep on the sofa. He was awakened by his alarm at 3 a.m. after 2 hours of sleep. He splashed water on his face, brushed his teeth, changed into jeans and sneakers, and locked the vault and the outer door. He left town on Highway 90 along the beach and stopped for gas at an all-night convenience store where cash was still welcome and there was only one security.